My name is Michael McCusker. I wish to celebrate Alexia Lee's birthday, April 19th, which is also the 239th anniversary of the shot heard round the world, the start of the American Revolution in 1775. I would like to read an article, or a story, I should say. It wasn't an article, it's a story, by Lexie Lee, called The Birthday Coin, which I read a couple of years ago on her 18th birthday, and I think maybe once in between, 3 years ago, on her 18th birthday. The Birthday Coin by Lexie Lee. For my 18th birthday, I got a special and very cool present from my Uncle John. He gave me a 1,698-year-old Roman coin. Fact, because I love old things. The coin is a little chipped and rugged, but you can still see the face of Licinius I, who ruled ancient Rome, where the coin was minted in 313 AD. Fact. I began to wonder how the coin had traveled and his adventures from ancient Rome to Astoria, Oregon. In 317, Constantine, who ruled the Roman Empire with Licinius I, celebrated his son Constantine II's first birthday, the same day the child was named Caesar. Fact. I imagine a household slave, Aria, slipping my coin into the child's pocket, as it was the only thing she had to give this favored child. For 90 years or so, it could have laid in the dirt where the young Constantine II dropped it when he was playing with it. The Visigoths destroyed Rome in 410. Fact. A conquering soldier possibly picked it up when he spotted something shiny in the dust and absentmindedly put it in his pocket as the army started off to Spain. When the army reached Toledo in Spain, he could have met and fallen in love with a beautiful daughter of a Spanish blacksmith who repaired his dented battle sword. It was Amaranta's birthday, and the Visigoth, Hothus, wanted to give her something special. As soldiers usually don't carry much with them, the only thing Hothus could think to give Amaranta was my coin. When the Visigoth army left Spain, Hothus thought often of Amaranta and the coin. The coin might have been stolen from Amaranta by a Vandal woman named Radegund, who cooked for the army. The coin may have found itself in Africa because that was where the Vandals went after battling in Spain and losing to the Visigoths. Fact. She was staying with the blacksmith and his daughter and took the coin with her when the Vandals fled to northern Africa. Fact. The Vandals made Tunisia their home. Fact. And the coin could have become an heirloom that passed down through Radegund's family for 300 years. Her great, 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 great grandson, Lothar, received the coin on his 20th birthday as he prepared to go to battle with the Arabs who conquered Carthage around 700 AD. Fact. Perhaps when the Arabs divided the belongings of the defeated Vandals, as was the custom in war, a Muslim man, Anwar, was delighted to realize that he was in possession of an ancient Roman coin. He could give it to his nephew, Aqil, for his 10th birthday, when he returned to Mecca. Although Aqil loved his coin, he made a wise decision to drop it into a wishing well and made a birthday wish of peace for his people. The coin eventually was covered by hundreds of other wishing coins, remaining buried for hundreds of years. During the Crusades in 1095, it could have happened that a Spanish crusader, Alfonso, climbed into a well in a desert oasis near Mecca to try to find water for his thirsty troops. He discovered that the well wasn't a drinking well, but a dry, ritual wishing well for coins. Leaving the coins mostly undisturbed, he recognized a Roman coin which would interest his twin brother, who collected coins, and decided to give it to him for his birthday. He returned to Spain with the coin, unaware of a growing hole in his coin purse. I imagine the coin making it to Spain, but dropped in the shallow water of Barcelona as Alfonso got off of his ship. During a storm in 1588, a Spanish soldier, Miguel, spotted my coin, now a little rusty, on the beach as he set off to fight the English with the Spanish Armada. During the defeat of the Armada, he lost the coin in battle, and it could have possibly been picked up as a trinket by an English peasant, Bernard, whose only daughter Mary waited for him fearfully, hoping he would return by her 16th birthday. When he gave her the coin on her birthday, she swore she would keep it forever. Mary Norris could have carried the coin in her small baggage when she sailed with other pilgrims on the Mayflower to the New World in 1620. She lost the coin in 1650 when she died at 76 years of age. Her husband, Isaac Allerton, put her prized possessions in a wooden box, and they were forgotten for about 50 years, till the father of Deborah Hitchborn bought the box at an auction and gave the coin to his newborn daughter. Deborah was the wife of Apollos Revoix, fact, and they were the parents of Paul Revere. Deborah could have given the coin to Paul on his 19th birthday as he took over the family metalsmith shop when Apollos suddenly died. Paul never removed the coin from his pocket and kept it for good luck. Then, in 1775, the coin flew out of Paul Revere's pocket as his horse raced wildly on his famous ride, which, some 200 years later, was Alexia's birth date, April 19th. It's possible the coin began a zigzag, stop-and-go, lost-and-found journey west by coach and pony express, by foot and on wagon trains from Boston to Oregon. It began when a Boston woman spotted the coin in 1836 while going to visit her daughter, who was starting her journey westward to Missouri by stagecoach, leaving on her 18th birthday with the birthday coin to remember her mother left behind. She might have sold it to start her life in Independence, Missouri, and years later my birthday coin found itself traveling to Colorado by horseback with a hardy band of adventurers. It was lost as the men panned for gold in the Rockies, and I imagine a pioneer woman washing clothes in the stream finding the coin. The next day she left in a wagon train for Oregon, through Utah and Idaho, the Dalles, and finally to the Columbia River in Oregon, where the settlers made their home near Portland in 1849. In 2011, a beautiful young woman, Samantha, Sam, Jewel, whose family was among the original wagon train settlers, needed money to save her home from foreclosure and decided to sell her beloved family coin on the internet. She hoped that it would be a special coin for a special person, and her wish came true. On April 19th, 2011, I opened a tiny birthday gift from my Uncle John and got a big surprise, an ancient Roman coin. Fact. And that was The Birthday Coin by Alexia Lee. And her birthday is the same day as Paul Revere's ride, 19 April. And you might have noticed as I was reading that everybody who was given the coin was given it on their birthdays all through history. Now I shall read a story written by a friend of Alexia's. They have known each other most of their lives. He uses the nom de plume of William M. Kessler. And he wrote a story, The Victory Column of the Sunset Empire. And I believe I've read it on the air at least once, and I'm reading it again. And this is in tribute to both Alexia and to the real person behind the nom de plume of William Kessler. The history of the world is a story of war. At the dawn, when man gained sentience and lost innocence, he picked up the club. He never put it down for hundreds of millennia, except briefly, to pick up something of greater offensive utility. And so he proceeded through the ages, exchanging branch for flint, flint for blade, blade for arrow, arrow for ball, and ball for bullet, until he held at last the pinnacle of his yearnings, something with which he could make the earth itself shudder, which he could use to rain down fire like the gods he had revered. But long before he held the atom, he held simpler tools of war, and also of craft, and he began to mark his successes in enterprises of violence with artifacts. The original monument to war was probably painted on a cave wall in Paleolithic times, and, as the reason for it has long since faded with the pigment, it is doubtful whether any academic could positively say that it was made in celebration or mourning. But there can be no doubt that the more mature, grand monuments of classical antiquity were intended for the former purpose. Victory columns are monuments erected to glorify successful revolutions, battles, and wars. One of the first such monuments, Trajan's Column, was built to commemorate the Roman Emperor Trajan's victory in the Dacian Wars. It also recorded said victory in detail, albeit historically dubious detail, on a long bas-relief mural which winds around it. The column is 125 feet tall, and the 53-ton capital block had to be lifted to the top. If any of those specifics sounds familiar, that is no coincidence. Our very own Astoria Column was modeled after Trajan's Column. It is also 125 feet tall, with a spiraling frieze. The frieze may be similar to its source of inspiration in that it glosses over some of the more unimportant details or glorifies the important ones. Indeed, Astoria's column bears more than a superficial, intentional resemblance to Trajan's column. It is also a victory column. It and the community of Europeans surrounding it would not be there were it not for the Indian Wars. No history lesson is necessary to bolster this fact. It undeniably stands alone, without supports. A proud people, to put it tritely, was displaced by the European settlers of the majestic Pacific Northwest. Many were murdered in the same spirit as the atrocities committed by the conquering kings of ages past in distant lands. Many bona fide apologies have been given already for that injustice, and this is not another. Rather, it is an apology that all the apologies that came before were in vain. History played out as it did, and the things which were done and can't be changed. Those who wronged directly are dead, and those who were directly wronged are dead likewise. But man can still unlearn what he learned so long ago, the art of war. He retains, hypothetically, the ability to learn. The column is a monument to great things, truly, but take that with a grain of salt. Those things are, in fact, terrible when viewed objectively. Who can fault anyone who sees the victory column erected by the foreign invaders of the Sunset Empire and understands what it really signifies? We should keep it where it is forever to help us remember, and let us never again have reason to raise another like it. I'd like to acknowledge a certain choice I've made, to use the noun man in reference to humankind. While I'm aware of the political incorrectness of this usage, the decision was a matter of style and convenience. And anyway, I doubt that any woman reading this article, or listening to it now, will be too deeply insulted. Hopefully. And that was the victory column of the Sunset Empire, by a young man who used the nom de plume of William Kessler. Now I'd like to read something that appeared in the April 11th, 2014 opinion section of the Daily Astorian. It's by former managing editor Patrick Webb, and I believe it gives an explanation for Patrick's abrupt departure as managing editor. By Patrick Webb, fair play, referee's motto, but it isn't life's. The most surprising aspect about giving up soccer refereeing isn't the lost camaraderie, enjoyment of the sport, or even the money. It's that it wasn't my decision. My failing body decided for me. Just about everyone who has sat on the raised berm above the H.H. Snow Volunteer Field in Warrenton and watched a game has questioned my eyesight. Fair enough. That's the job of a fan, whether from Astoria, Seaside, or out of town. To loudly recommend the referee visit an optician is a time-honored tradition when fans witness calls, or more often non-calls, from the touchlines and feel aggrieved. I am upset because I wasn't allowed to retire from the field at a time of my own choosing. When I emigrated from England at 23, I fancied myself as a soccer player. But one season in the Portland-Vancouver Adult League's lower division convinced me I didn't have the size, upper body strength, or the killer instinct. So I took up the whistle. Since then, I have refereed in Oregon, Washington, Alaska, Nebraska, and Indiana, sometimes 75 games a year. 5 or so years ago, when I turned 50, I started teasing my assigner, Tina Toyas, about retiring from field refereeing. After 29 years of running around muddy fields with a whistle, I knew I couldn't maintain the pace and intensity of officiating high school varsity contests for much longer. I never truly admitted it, but I was losing my edge. As a referee association, our group has done a poor job of recruiting and developing new referees. Myself, Toyas, Bruce Holt, and Mauro Macarino have borne the brunt of the fall schedule year after year. We're all the same approximate age, so this signals disaster if our bodies give up the ghost and we're no longer able to run. I should have guessed mine would be the first to fail. Toyas is the physical education teacher at Clatsop Community College. Holt maintains a rigorous exercise regimen as part of his job. Macarino, a former player in Mexico, runs effortlessly. In a race I would struggle to keep up, I got by, intuitively anticipating the flow of the play to be in the right place to make the call. The health trouble began a couple of years ago when I encountered medical problems that were not fixed by pills. Readers of a family newspaper likely don't want the details, so let's just say my functions weren't functioning. Next up was surgery. Back home from the hospital, all seemed well for a couple of days. But on the third, I woke, tiptoed to the kitchen to make the coffee and happened to look down. My left leg was all purple, the color of those flared trousers we all wore in the 1970s. Life has never been the same. Emergency room staff in Astoria recognized the seriousness of my giant blood clot, stabilized me with skill and care, loaded me into the back of an ambulance, and the medics ambulance crew whisked me off at Formula One speeds to Oregon Health and Science University. 5 days there cemented my appreciation of doctors, nurses, and nursing assistants. Who on earth would choose that profession? But I'm glad they do. Being in a hospital bed at OHSU, Pill Hill, in Portland, is like being in a classroom. Doctors make daily rounds to discuss a patient's progress with a gaggle of students in tow. Once I counted 7 eager note-takers circling my bed. They lift your flimsy gown, peer at your unmentionables, and discuss your bodily functions with earnestness. When you arrive during the night nursing shift, the patient orientation is somewhat lacking. But by morning, you have discovered that meals are ordered by phone from a room service menu that would put many restaurants to shame. Steak, salmon, design your own sandwiches, plus desserts, including cheesecake with berry coulis. There are no jokes about horrible hospital food here. It was a remarkable experience. Time to think about life's basics while nurses are giving you medicine, and all you have to worry about is food, rest, mild exercise, and bodily functions. Most astonishing was my discharge nurse teaching me how to inject myself with blood thinners. Never in a million years did I think I could ever cope with that. Now I take 3 pills a day. I walk with a cane, and sometimes I need 2. I drive an automatic because I cannot manage left foot clutch pedal. And yet I know that I am still much better off than many. Without insurance through my job, I might have had to sell my house to pay for my 5-figure operation. I wonder about our system where health insurance is tied to employment, and am glad federal authorities are trying to fix it. I have had many reasons to be reduced to tears the past year, but the only time I actually cried was lining up at the licensing department for my first temporary handicapped parking placard. I just couldn't help it. My fears about the potential permanence of my disabled state suddenly welled up as I presented the clerk with a form signed by my doctor indicating my inability to walk without pain or difficulty. Doctors are one thing, but a government agency literally stamping my record with the D word was more than I could take. As I leaned on my cane and limped out to my car, I vowed only to use the red placard when I really need it. Daily life has changed forever. I cannot move without a reminder that a three-decade hobby likely is no more. Every time I open my closet, alongside my suits and shirts, I see rows of referee uniforms. I wore none last year and have little prospect this year either. For 29 years, I did my best to ensure fair play in a sport I love. There's something inherently unfair about losing my 30th year. My absence meant I missed the last seasons for retiring coaches, Jerry Bolsevert and Dave Rouse. I hope I pronounced the names correctly. Two gentlemen who had been stalwarts of our North Coast High School and youth programs for decades. Both have spent 16 years yelling at me, mostly questioning my eyesight, but also my knowledge of the laws of the game, my positioning, and even timekeeping. I admire their dedication. I miss their humor. Both are qualified referees, which adds credibility to their catcalls. I commend their service, but I'm upset I wasn't there for their finales. A week before the operation, I'd flown to Reno, Nevada for the Who's Quadrophenia concert and was killing time browsing music and sporting goods stores. Soccer refs used to be the men in black, but in the early 1990s, international authorities, mindful of the heat during Summer World Cups, experimented with colored uniform shirts, including silver and orange. In the U.S., they settled on yellow, adding blue, red, and mostly green as alternates. Referee buddies had teased me that I needed to obtain the new green shirt. I saw one on sale in Reno. It was cheap, but something held me back. I didn't buy it. Was it because I don't think I look good or sharp in a green uniform? Or was it a premonition that I would never wear it? And that was Fair Play, Referee's Motto, But It Isn't Life's, by Patrick Webb, who is now the former managing editor of the Daily Asturian. Patrick's a damn good newspaper man, if I can give my opinion, and to me, to use an old English phrase, a hail fellow well met. He has been on KMUN more than once, and I hope he might come by as a volunteer. I would like to hear Patrick on the air. I'd like to read something now from a woman named Mary Jane Brewster, who used to send poems to my newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, for maybe 15 or 20 years. She lived in Portland. I'm not sure if she's still alive, to tell you the truth. And she wrote this poem, April 2nd, 1986, A Cool Friday Confession on the Crucifixion of Jesus, by Mary Jane Brewster. I confess to Almighty God and to you, my brothers and sisters, that I have sinned through my own fault, in my thoughts and in my deeds, in what I have done and what I have failed to do. Every time we find an excuse to look the other way when encountering a dirty, ragged, homeless sister or brother on the city streets, we have sinned and Jesus is crucified again. Every time we're too tired to make that one last effort to listen to the concerns and all too valid complaints of a child, a friend, or a neighbor, we have sinned, and Jesus is crucified again. Every time we're afraid of making waves, so back off from taking a stand to support our coworkers in their battles with management for pay equity, affirmative action, and maintenance of hard-won wages and working conditions, we have sinned, and Jesus is crucified again. Every time we're too busy to write those letters to senators and representatives, informing them of our unalterable opposition to Star Wars, nuclear weapons tests, Contra aid, military intervention in the Middle East, and social program budget cuts, we have sinned, and Jesus is crucified again. The hour indeed is late. The prophecies of Revelation are coming true, with earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, wars and rumors of wars, disease, starvation, suffering, and death worldwide. If we fail at this critical moment in history to place our property and our possessions, our livelihoods, and our lives on the line in the cause of lasting peace and justice for all creations, we have failed to accept the responsibility assigned us for our part in the resurrection and the coming of God's kingdom to earth, and Jesus is crucified again. I confess to Almighty God and to you, my brothers and sisters, that I have sinned. And that was by Mary Jane Brewster. I hope she's still around, and if she isn't, I certainly enjoyed her poetry over those years and her frame of mind. And I'd like to read another poem for Earth Day, which is the 22nd. Earth's Checklist, an Earth Day poem by Margaret Leah Bowler. Say what you think what you say, for what would Mother Nature do if she saw her Earth this way? If she saw all the pollution, all the smog, all the waste, all the careless forest fires, all the killings just from taste, all the rainforest destruction, the acid pouring from the sky, the shooting, the logging, killing species by and by, all the deadly fertilizer being sprayed upon the ground, the oil clogging up the beaches, yet the world is going round. What would Mother Nature do? What would Mother Nature do? First, she would put a stop to the pollution, clear the acid from the sky, prevent the careless forest fires, save each species by and by, stop the rainforest destruction and the smog and the waste, halt the shooting and most logging and the killings just from taste, ban the deadly fertilizer, start to clean up the ground, make our home a better place, the whole world round. But Mother Nature softly speaks, her voice is hard to hear, yet when she is listened to, she can be heard from far and near. And listen to her closely, for we've got some things to do. Come on, come here, and pull up a seat, for you can help on Earth Day, too. Come, go get a move on. Stop the pollution and the waste. After all, we are the future. Make our Earth a better place. Happy Earth Day, everyone. And that was by Margaret Leah Bowler, Earth's Checklist. And she wrote it in 2001, when she was about 10 or 11. And I published it in my paper for the Marpril 2001 issue. And I'd like to close with a quote by Rachel Carson from her book Silent Spring, written in 1962, or at least published in 1962. Over increasingly large areas of the United States, spring now comes unheralded by the return of the birds, and the early mornings are strangely silent, where once they were filled with the beauty of spring song. This sudden silencing of the song of birds, this obliteration of the color and beauty and interest they lend to our world have come about swiftly, insidiously, and unnoticed by those whose communities are as yet unaffected. And that was Rachel Carson. And as I was walking here this morning, I was able to stop and listen to a couple of birds singing to each other. And it almost sounded as they were singing to me. And this has been Michael McCusker. I might be here next Thursday if certain things do not happen. And among the worst would possibly be not the drones, not the falling into the river, nor any other things like the sky falling, but the silence of birds would affect me greatly. That might put me off from coming here. I would know the world has ended. I wish you all a happy Earth Day.